I've asked each speaker to introduce himself, so Ari, please do that before you introduce
yourself. I'm Ari Legwater. I taught in the chemistry department for a number of years, 30 to be exact. I also did some history of science. That's how I've gotten to know Ted. So I also know this is a hard act to follow, Ted. So I'd like to talk about science, culture, and belief, Thomas Kuhn's legacy. I'm going to be brief here. It's a work in progress. And I also want to end with some Christian reflections. In 1964, Scientific American's short review of Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions ended with a veritable put-down, stating that the book was, quote, much ado about very little. It advances a skeptical relativism that has long been fashionable among historians and sociologists. These are Kuhn's books, by the way. It would be interesting to meet and query the reviewer, who was not identified, after more than 1.5 million copies of SSR had been sold, and its fourth commemorative edition was published in 2012. In retrospect, it may have been all too easy to dismiss a physicist turned historian of science, interested in philosophical matters, and one who had not received tenure at Harvard. But Kuhn did not go down easily. He struck a nerve that had been itching for a long time. So what I'd like to do is tease this out a bit. My interest is seeing science as a part of culture. It's been a very popular movement, particularly for a lot of postmodernists. Is there anything we can learn from that in terms of a Christian understanding of scientific activity? So, as all of you know, I'd like to follow this sort of a outline, talk about the received tradition briefly, the Vienna Circle, in which tradition Kuhn's book was published as in part of a series, as we'll see. Talk a bit about Kuhn's challenge, talk about some Anglo-American responses, I'll be brief here. Some continental voices that raised questions about scientific activity, and then some Christian reflections. Setting the context, the traditional view of the development of science was popularized very much by the Vienna Circle in 1929, its manifesto, The Scientific Conception of the World by the Vienna Circle. It envisioned a progressive future for philosophy, linked to developments in the natural and social sciences, logic and the foundations of mathematics, the arts, social democracy, and public education. Quote, the scientific conception of the world serves life, and life receives it. It aimed to create a unified science, unified in method and logic. Now, the interesting part is Thomas Kuhn's book of 1962, the first edition, was published as part of the foundations of the unity of science. Part of this broad Vienna Circle approach. In it, there's a lot one can say about this, but there are two chief points that I want to make. I think that characterize the book. It talks about normal science, viewed often as puzzle solving, which advances, it's taught to our students, at a time anomalies begin to arise, questions begin to arise, a crisis develops, and we develop what's called an extraordinary science. Revolutions are part of this pattern of shifting from one science, normal science, to through a revolutionary phase to a new phase of normal science. And that shift is described as a paradigm shift. So the question becomes, what causes this paradigm shift? And Kuhn, being primarily influenced, I think, through psychology and psychological interests that he had, viewed that as a potential cause But one also could see that there are other social factors at work, and could even worldview or religious factors be at work in this change, in this paradigm shift from normal science once it develops into a crisis phase and shifts to a new form of normal science. Kuhn's challenge to the unity of science motif, I think you could describe various ways, but here are seven major points, I think. Science is not cumulative. Alive science does not have a tight deductive structure. Living scientific concepts are not particularly precise. Methodological unity of science is false. The sciences themselves are disunified, and the context of justification cannot be separated from the context of discovery. In other words, we don't know exactly how you come to a discovery, how you may have stepped out of bed the wrong way one morning and come up with a discovery. But how you justify what you've discovered has certain rules and logical justification. Kuhn says it's not so easy to separate those two. Science is in time and is essentially historical. Now, you can well imagine what the responses were. I mean, Dudley Shapiro, a philosopher of science in Chicago, says it's irrational. You're introducing irrational factors, social factors, psychological factors, maybe even religious factors in this particular paradigm shift. Scientific realist says the inevitable result is it's going to lead to relativism. It's going to lead to relativism. Imre Lakatos, a Hungarian philosopher of science, describes it as mob psychology. And if you want to get a recent book, it's just off the press by Elroy Morris, a filmmaker, The Ashtray, or The Man Who Denied Reality, you should read this book. Morris was in one of Kuhn's seminars at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. And an ashtray was thrown by Kuhn at him. This is a vendetta against Kuhn. So you should read this book.
Did he keep the ashtray?
That I don't know. That I don't know. Now, historians of science, in general, have had a difficult time accepting Kuhn's approach, more or less. They've had enough difficulty introducing relating history of science to general history. That's been a problem. And there's also been a paradox between some older history of science and some of the newer versions, which introduce a lot of more of these social, economic, religious factors in the development of science. Science in context, it's sometimes called. Now, here's Ian Hacking's assessment. He wrote an introduction to, I think, the third edition of Kuhn's SSR, in which he says this: it is easy nowadays to be flippant about unity. It is also possible to be angry. Some of the current rage against reason is directed at an ideology of science that says there is one ultimate reality, one ultimate truth, one road to truth, the scientific method, one sound mode of reasoning, one rational way of speaking. Just as God wrote one book of words, the Bible, so God wrote one book of nature, one author, one language, one book. Unity is built in, or is it? So this questioning of the unity of science, whether it's governed by a method, let's say, that applies to all the sciences. Now, I have to be very brief here, but you can well imagine, if you begin to introduce social factors, how far do you take that? How far do you take that? There's a very strong version called the Edinburgh School, David Bloor and Barry Barnes, in which they argue, look, this paradigm is shared by a community. And if you're a student, you're introduced to this community through education. So through persuasion, for example, through people in authority. So for them, science is through and through socially conditioned. Scientific beliefs inculcated by relations of authority, persuasion, rhetoric, what have you. One thing they do emphasize, which I think is beneficial, they emphasize very much the role of science as practice, as a scientific activity. So the theoretical, the conceptual is there to a certain extent, but it's downplayed by their emphasis on science as an activity with practices that are not logically spelled out. You can think of, for example, Michael Polanyi's version of tacit, what am I thinking of?
Tacit knowledge.
Yeah, tacit knowledge, you know, ways to do things that can't be spelled out in terms of a set of rules. Let me give you another example. What's happened is that through this socialization process, we've arrived at a thoroughgoing historicization of science and its categories: discovery, evidence, argument, experiment, expert, laboratory, instrument, image, replication, law. For this school, this has all been socially confined and socially defined. There's also the issue of closure in scientific controversies. For example, a book by Peter Galison at Harvard, How Do Experiments End? How do you decide when to end an experiment? What is that conditioned by? So there are rhetorical processes of normalization, standardization, metrilization in scientific practice. So this socialization and historization factor. There's a book just out, 2004, by Samioto, who says, look, if this socialization takes hold to this extent, what's the fate of the empirical sciences? Maybe it'll work in sociology, he says, but what about the empirical sciences? So now people respond to this. Yes, there are social communities. Yes, there are scientific communities in which you are introduced. How do we relate that to the typical way we used to look at science? And this is a book that I've read by Martin Rudwick, a historian of geologists, probably the leading historian of geologists, The Great Devonian Controversy. And he's worried about this thing. Is it simply a matter of discovery, the way a realist might talk about it? Or is it a matter of construction, the way the social constructionists and the sociology of science people talk about it? Is that an adequate metaphor for the production of scientific knowledge? And in this book, The Great Devonian Controversy, which deals with how to define the Devonian stratum, the controversy shows how new knowledge is shaped from materials of the natural world, but it becomes scientific knowledge only as those materials are forged into new shapes with new meanings on the anvil of heated argumentative debates. Let me give you another example. This is by Robert Crease, a physicist. His book, The Play of Nature, 1993. He tries to make a distinction between production and performance. In production, the setting up, let's say, of an experiment, the role of production allows us to resolve the philosophical problem of what I call the antinomic character of scientific knowledge. The fact that on the one hand, it is affected by the historical, cultural, and social contexts in which it develops, but that on the other hand, it also has a kind of objectivity or independence from those contexts. The social constructivists stress the dependence of science on historical, cultural, and social contexts, while the positivists and realists stress its objectivity. He tries to bridge this by saying, look, when the production takes months to set up an experiment, once it's setting up pretty well, there's a performance. You're examining electrons here and electrons there and electrons there, and they look alike. And it looks very objective. So that's one way he tries to bridge this question of whether it's construction or simply discovery. I should go here. There's also been sort of French influences, Gaston Bachelard in the 1930s and 1940s. He was struck by the fact that what do scientists work with? What sort of objects do they work with? Are they immediately given to us? And how is this involved in terms of the technological know-how that you need to be able to look at something? So he stresses an epistemological break between pre-scientific thought anchored in the immediacy of everyday experience and scientific thought developed within the contours of a scientific culture and community. So he wants to move from an everyday object that's in front of us, so to say, to speak, to the making of a scientific object in a research environment. And he introduced this idea of a phenomenal technique. He's very interested in the role that technology plays in giving us the scientific objects to look at. It's not just there immediately, it's mediated through the technological structure. He talks about instruments as being concrete, theorized instruments. But so he places a lot of emphasis on phenomena and instrument, object and experience, concept and method. They're all engaged in an ongoing process of mutual instruction. I won't spell very much about Bruno Latour, which you've perhaps heard a lot about. Let me just give one quote of Bruno Latour. "We do not wish to say that facts do not exist or that there is no such thing as reality. Our position is not relativist. Our point is that out-there-ness is the consequence of scientific work rather than its cause." Again, they're very concerned about, for example, looking at the gene. It's not in front of you. All kinds of instrumentation techniques are necessary before you can begin to talk about the scientific object, the gene. They're concerned about how technology plays a role. One of the most leading historians of biology, I think, is this Swiss-German, Hans-Georg Rheinberger. He has a wonderful book, Towards a History of Epistemic Things, Synthesizing Proteins in the Test Tube, and another book, An Epistemology of the Concrete. Again, it's an emphasis on a practice-oriented as opposed to theory-dominated account of knowledge production. And the question is not how knowing subjects might attain an undisguised view of their objects. Rather, the question becomes what conditions had to be created for objects to be made into objects of empirical knowledge. It's not ready to be the mind. Now, the categories are quite different. He's quite influenced by Heidegger and others. But this is how he describes it. "The sciences are characterized by a permanent process of reorientation and reshuffling of the boundary between what is thought to be known and what is beyond imagination. Such a reorientation has at times been characterized as an approximation, an adjustment to truth or reality as a proposed end or goal. In contrast, there are reasons to pretend that the sciences are much better understood as continuously engendering what Gaston Bachelard has called the scientific real, thereby reshaping their agendas through their own action." Here's a couple of quotes from his book, Toward the History of Epistemic Things. "Experimental scientists do not read the book of nature. They do not depict reality, but they do not construct reality either. They're not engaged in Platonistic exercises, in copy theory-guided asymptotic approximations to reality, or in bluntly social constructivist endeavors." So again, for Rheinberger, this centrality of phenomenon technique, that reality, nature, appears simultaneously as agent. He doesn't deny reality. It pushes back. And at the same time, it's an epistemological obstacle. So entities generated in the laboratory seen as hybrids or model organisms of both nature and culture. So that's the way Latour talks about it, too. We oftentimes look at hybrids. The gene, yes, it's nature, but yes, how do we look at it viewing through all these techniques that we need to be able to talk about it? Phenomena are always material and discursive entities. Now, he tries to play this out in his books. He's a wonderful historian of molecular biology, and his books will show you how the idea of what he just came out with a book called The Gene at the University of Chicago Press. How this idea of the gene, or what the gene is, or how to talk about the gene, is a reflection of bringing other research fields into the development of molecular biology. The point being this, by Tim Lenoir: we need to examine the configurations of instruments, the techniques, and the conditions that have generated productive experimental settings and operational concepts materially tied to them. I think a similar question could be raised about the atom. I won't go into that. You know, what is the atom? How do you view an atom? How do you view an atom within a molecule? It's not something you see before you. Spectroscopy, et cetera, other techniques have shown. How much time do I have?
A couple minutes.
Okay, my point is this. If you're a Christian, do you have to choose between this subjective view, social constructionist view, or an objective view, let's say, of science, of scientific activity? I think both positions assume the power and self-assured status of a knowing subject or in our human ability to understand nature. I think we need to appeal to a biblical view of creation. And that means that interpretation is going to be involved. And I'm relying primarily on Janie K. Smith, his book, The Fall of Interpretation. The hermeneutical structure of creation is good. It produces goods, a plurality of interpretations and a diversity of readings. The sin of Babel was its quest for unity. One interpretation, one reading, one people. So I don't think we need to be afraid of interpretation and a variety of interpretations. Not all interpretations are as good as others. I mean, it's not that anything goes. And just very briefly, I've talked too much about this, but I think if I look at scientific practice, I think we need to stress time and time again the centrality of religion. We are religious creatures. It isn't so much a question of integrating science and religion. Religion is lived out in our scientific work. We also think I need to stress creational continuities. Our work as scientists before the face of God is winnowed, but there is a new creation, and we do not know what follows into the new creation. I think we have to stress time and time again that science is at best a listening to God's revelation. It's not an imposition on our part, but it's a listening, it's an interpretation, it's an exploration, it's a reinterpretation. When you have to recognize the suffering and brokenness in our work, we also need to be very much aware of the historical awareness of traditions. And I won't argue these points, but for me at least, what scientific practice is not thinking God's thoughts after him as a form of natural theology. Thinking of God's revelation as being composed of two independent revelations. And I think it's a question of integrality. Not so much integration, but integral. More could be said. I'll leave it here. I'll leave this up. By the way, here are some of the books that I relied on.
Yeah,
I got started 2 minutes late.
Yes. We should go back to the previous slide just so we can see. Y'all want to ask some questions.
Okay. Yes.
So, one legacy of Kuhn that I see in the evangelical church is that he's invoked to dismiss science that people don't like. Yeah. You only believe in evolution because that's the paradigm that you've inculcated in. And, feels like a misuse of Kuhn. Do you have a critique of that?
Well, Kuhn hated that. He says once a student came in and said, I thank you both for telling me about paradigms. I don't need them anymore. he hated the misuse of which people put it. I mean, there are problems in Kuhn about incommensurability. You know, whether one science can talk to another science, and if the science of Newton's time should be able to talk to the science of our time, those sorts of issues. I don't think you can really, I think there's the fabric of the world, the push of reality keeps suggesting that there are some continuities between one science, one version of, let's say, physics, and the next version of physics. That you completely overthrow it. Yes?
So I'm a scientist. I always find these things quite interesting. I just kind of go in and try to do the best I can.
Yes.
Think through, but I never think of those terms. So a question I would have is so trying to understand what people like me are doing.
Yes.
So has anybody done an experiment of the following? You know, maybe, and I know gravitational waves is one that Harry Collins has written a lot about. So you see an area that's starting out, and as a historian or a philosopher, you can say, okay, I think they're going to do this, and you follow it along. And at the end, at some point, someone gets a Nobel Prize, and everybody thinks science was done.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it works, right? Yeah. Whether the historians agree or not, Nobel Prize. So has anybody done it to think, well, okay, this is what I think is going to go, to watch it and see if it works, and then assess at the end, were they right, and did they mean to, have they taken an experimental approach to the...
Well, I wouldn't say an experimental approach. I know that anthropologists have spent times, long periods of time in the lab, trying to understand the project that's being
studied.
Not in an experimental sort of way, but in the way a sociologist or anthropologist would describe what's happening. I can't count the name of the person right now, but that's been done. And Reinberger, to a certain extent, has done that too.
Yeah.
He's got a background in molecular biology, a background in philosophy, and he spent time.
Is he doing molecular biology
yes.
while he's doing history?
Yes, yes. That's why his books I find so interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Before the next question, right, let's have people come in and find seats.
Okay, sorry. there was a question in the back.
So, I just wanted to make a remark. I mean, it seems to me that one of the things that Kuhn's structure of scientific organizations did was to put the nail in the coffin of positivism, or a kind of scientism.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that was very salutary. Actually, scientists who take life seriously ought to be very thankful for that.
Not too many are.
But, well, maybe they aren't. So it seemed to me that would be a very positive way of thinking about Kuhn. And in fact, of course, it's the interpreters of Kuhn that tended to take his work to the extreme. I think even those of us who are scientists, to the core, when we read Kuhn, we see some truth there.
Yeah.
We see that he's actually onto something.
Right.
But a lot of people have taken him far beyond the place that Kuhn himself ever went.
Right, and would want to go either. I know, that's true. And yet, there are other questions involved. Can you give a sort of a final, I mean, does it challenge the theory of correspondence to what truth is? You know, is truth something you uncover, or is truth a process of uncovering? That's, for example, what Reinberger is arguing in terms of Heidegger. So in other words, if you're a scientific realizer, there's sort of a final truth that's approachable. These people are saying, not so fast. It's a question of interpretation and reinterpretation. And you're going to have to weigh whether your interpretation is better than someone else's interpretation.
Yeah, but see, that's the problem. It's a failure on the part, in many cases, of the sociological critics of science, who've taken this extreme view. It's a failure to recognize that actually science, viewed as the study of nature, has a certain compass and has a certain emphasis and a certain approach which produces knowledge which is in many ways reliable because it's reproducible.
That's true. And this is the final word about the atom or the gene. I mean, if you look at the history of the atom and its role in a molecule.
And then I'll just have to
switch.
The interesting one critical element of this is the recognition of an objective reality that exists outside of us that we will never really fully know, but that objective reality is there, and that our research is an attempt to more approach that external reality. Because otherwise, a Kuhnian view ends up with just kind of going on random walks with no assurance that this next paradigm is any closer to that external, to what exists or not. I think that's one thing that social critics have often seen it. It's just this kind of random walk where we're not really approaching any closer to understanding what that
I don't know
truly
do this
reality.
We're dummies.
But question I guess that I have in my mind, I think as Christians we know that there is a reality that pushes back.
Right.
But our access to reality is always via our human
Right.
Interpretation.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
So, first comment. I read Thomas Kuhn some 30 years ago when I was actually working at a lab bench. I was a lab bench. And I was absolutely fascinated because I felt like the guy was standing next to me. He knew what I was going through as the person actually doing science every day. Because he understood the messiness of science, how things worked and didn't work. I have a more fun question to ask for you that kind of comes out of the give and take of the critics that you were talking about here. My question is science basically reductionist or inductive? I see that running through a lot of scenes what you're saying here. That I see a good clear answer once you're
organic chemistry that I thought as an interpretation of the fact that molecules can be viewed as having structures and interpretation. There is a quantum mechanics. I remember reading in 1968 an article in JAX, must the molecule have a shape? Quantum mechanics is difficult to make that connection. And yet, an interpretation of molecules as having shape, having valence, if that might have been directly available, go a long way to coming out without even introducing quantum mechanics. So, in other words, there's a level of interpretation.
Sorry. Thanks, sorry.